Old Testament survey. We're in Lecture 26, Study Pack 13B. We're going to be looking at the prophets Hosea, Joel, Amos, and Obadiah this morning. As we move on to studying the minor prophets, it's important to realize that their prophecies were not minor prophecies, but they're just as valid and as important as God's revelation of himself as the writings of what we call the major prophets. In the Hebrew canon, the minor prophets appear as one book. Together, they contain only one more chapter than Isaiah and have only 1,050 verses compared to Jeremiah's 1,346 verses. These prophets all proclaim messages that give direction to God's people. God positioned the prophets in history, pointing to his authority and disclosing in detail the unfolding of the future, in particular in relationship to the nation of Israel and to the nations in relationship to them. The prophets each give a vivid account of the consequences for those who are living in disobedience, contrasting these with the victories that come through faith. There's a time when each believer through history is confronted with the words that we find in Haggai chapter 1, verse 5. Now, therefore, thus saith the Lord of hosts, consider your ways. Prophecy, as a prediction of things to come, cannot be separated from the revelation of God's will for men. The words of the prophets show God's power. They show God's wisdom. They also show God's response to our needs. Man cannot know what lies ahead of him. In fact, really, it's wonderful that God does not let us know ahead of time what lies ahead for us. We can't know what lies ahead for us, but God not only foreknows, but he reveals his will, showing his plans and his purposes for the future. The ministry of Hosea took place during the last 40 years of the northern kingdom. It was a time of great wickedness, but it began near the end of a period of military successes and prosperity for the nation of Israel and for the nation of Judah. There was the decline of the Assyrian Empire that was going on at the same time, of course, and both of the kingdoms of Jeremiah II, who was the king of Israel, and King Uzziah, who was the king of Judah, had prospered. Hosea prophesies about the revival of the power of Assyria under Tiglath-Pileser III. Hosea's ministry probably ended with the captivity of the northern kingdom. In 733 to 732 BC, the northern kingdom was made a puppet state of the Assyrian Empire. After plotting a revolt against Assyria, Israel was defeated and carried off into dispersion in 722 B.C. It was also during this time that the Assyrians assimilated Judah as a vassal state. And Hosea's prophecies were directed only to Israel, not to the nation of Judah. While he ministered for 40 years, Hosea's prophecies are brief. As with the other prophets, it's very probable that much of what he said was never written down. It was never recorded. But the Holy Spirit, who is the author of the Scriptures, only preserved the portions that were necessary for our reproof, correction, and instruction in righteousness. While Hosea's writings are brief, other Bible writers quote from him either directly or indirectly over 30 times. The background of Hosea's prophecies, like those of his contemporaries, Amos, Isaiah, Micah, and possibly Joel, must be understood in the context of God's covenant agreement with Israel. Israel must remain obedient to God, and God would bless her. Disobedience to God's covenant would bring judgment and eventually result in exile from the promised land. The oppression of Israel and its ultimate extinction by Assyria are the burden of Hosea's prophecies. Assyria was to Israel what Babylon was to Judah. the destroyer appointed by God. The destruction that we find going on in Israel was a result of Israel's idolatry, her anarchy, her tyranny, her murder, her drunkenness, lying, stealing, the other gross sins that were practiced in the nation of Israel. The knowledge of God was forgotten, and her priests were the leaders in Israel's shame. My wife recently talked to a grandmother who sat down with her six-year-old granddaughter and asked her, "Do you know what the story of Christmas is?" And she had no idea what Christmas was even like. And it's really incredible because we're reaching a point even in our own nation where we're going to be dealing with these same kinds of issues. We're going to have to minister more and more as missionaries ministered to the heathen nations over the years. And they would have to come in and start from the very beginning and teach them everything from the very beginning. And we're reaching that point in our own land as well. The oppression of Israel and its ultimate extinction by Assyria, again, are God's, the burden of his prophecies. The knowledge of God was forgotten. The priests were the leaders in Israel's shame. We're getting to that point even in the United States, with the Episcopalian Church appointing a gay priest. I talked to a Methodist preacher last week who's very, very conservative. And he told me that the last annual meeting that they had of the Methodist Church, they were voting on a law for the Methodist Church about teaching sex education in Sunday school with a ban on any bias against sexual orientation. In other words, they're going to teach homosexuality in the Sunday school classes in the Methodist Church. This is how bad it's getting. And our priests, the quote-unquote priests in the United States, are the leaders in our shame. New kings ascended to the throne by murdering their predecessors. If you remember back to the history of Israel, at the conclusion of the nation of Israel, there was murder after murder after murder, assassination after assassination. And Hosea repeatedly warned Israel. He said this in Hosea chapter 1, verse 4. For yet a little while, and I will avenge the blood of Jezreel upon the house of Jehu, and will cause to cease the kingdom of the house of Israel. In Hosea 1, verse 6, he said, I will no more have mercy upon the house of Israel, but I will utterly take them away. In Hosea chapter 5, verse 1, he says, Hear ye this, O priests, and hearken, ye house of Israel, and give ye ear, O house of the king, for judgment is toward you, because you have been a snare upon Mizpah and a net spread upon Tabor. As the prophet Jeremiah was to Judah, Hosea was known as a weeping prophet to Israel. His prophecies are filled with entreaties for Israel to return to God, assuring them of God's forgiveness and favor. As we look at the book of Hosea, Hosea chapters 1 through 3 give a personal narrative of Hosea's unhappy marriage relationship with a harlot. Gomer, his wife, was a former prostitute. She sold herself to do evil, eventually deserting her husband and her children, and sinking lower and lower, finally being offered for sale in the slave market. Even then, Hosea loved her and redeemed her from the slave market, restoring her to his house once again, where she sat desolate for many days. His forgiving spirit toward his unfaithful wife was a fitting illustration of God's love for wayward Israel. The first three chapters of Hosea sum up the entire book of Hosea, setting forth God's relationship to his people, revealing his tender love toward Israel in spite of Israel's rebellion and unfaithfulness. Through the sorrow of his own unanswered love, Hosea understood God's grief over the spiritual adultery of his people. Hosea knew and understood something of the infinite love of God, who was willing to follow after Israel to win the people back to love and faithfulness. As we look at Hosea's message, the major themes of sin, judgment, and salvation are clearly expressed. In Hosea chapter 4, verse 1, the prophet presses charges against Israel, saying, "There is no truth, nor mercy, nor knowledge of God in the land." He compares Israel's covenant relationship to the Lord with marriage, accusing Israel of spiritual adultery. Over the years, of course, we know that with Jeroboam the first, the nation of Israel had gone to the worship of the golden calves, but now Israel had turned to Baal, the Canaanite god of the storm and of fertility. They were counting on Baal not only to give them children, but also to give them good crops. And Baal was the god that was going to provide this. And as a result of their idolatry, God was going to turn his face from the nation of Israel. In Hosea chapter 4, verse 6 is a very, very well-known passage. "My people are destroyed for a lack of knowledge. Because thou hast rejected knowledge, I will also reject thee, that thou shalt be no priest to me. Seeing thou hast forgotten the law of thy God, I will also forget thy children." What a promise. And it's not a good promise for people, because who of us wants God to forget our children? I don't want God to forget my children. But God told the nation of Israel, because of the way you've been, because there's of your lack of knowledge, because you've rejected knowledge, I'm going to reject you. And I'll forget your children. Hosea's prophecies were very specific. They specifically included the prediction of the downfall of Samaria. Another specific prophecy was the deliverance of Judah from Assyria. He predicted the punishment of Judah and the final restoration of both Judah and Israel. Sometimes people look at the severity of God's judgment and they don't understand that God's judgment was disciplinary. God's judgment was disciplinary. It was intended to turn Israel back to God. In the New Testament, we find the same thing in the church age. "Brethren, if a man be overtaken in a fault, ye which are spiritual, restore such a one in a spirit of meekness, considering thyself, lest thou also be tempted." But the purpose of discipline in the church is restoration. It is not to be able to just kick out and say, we're rid of them. It's to try to restore people. And that's the goal of church discipline, to restore believers and get them back in their walk with God. Hosea's own reconciliation with his wayward wife illustrates Israel's ultimate restoration. Hosea chapter 3, verse 5 states this: "Afterward shall the children of Israel return and seek the Lord their God and David their king, and shall fear the Lord and his goodness in the latter days." And so the prediction is there. We find that all the way through the minor prophets, and really through all the prophets, you'll find that there's always an end in view. And while it may not happen right away, God says ultimately there's going to be a restoration. You know, I get kind of excited when I look at this, because really, the nation of Israel as a picture of the believer and God's dealing with the individual believer demonstrates very clearly, if God is going to restore Israel, it means that even a backslidden believer is going to be restored as well. Because the backslidden believer is never going to lose his salvation. Just like Israel will never cease to be God's chosen people, the believer will never cease to be God's child either. We go on now and we look at the prophet Joel. Jewish tradition places Joel in the days of King Uzziah. It's impossible to fix the exact date of the book, since there are no direct references in the first few verses which establish the time frame of his ministry. Joel makes no reference to Nineveh, which are the Assyrians, or the Babylonians, which are the Chaldeans, but does mention the Phoenicians, the Philistines, the Edomites, and the Egyptians. And so it must be assumed that his prophecy must have been written just before the time when the Assyrian and Babylonian empires were supreme, since Hosea also quotes from Joel. This makes Joel the earliest prophet of Judah, with his ministry beginning shortly after the days of Elijah and Elisha. It also gives a sequence of prophetic ministry from the days of the kingdom under Ahab until the end of Judah's existence. Although it was Israel which experienced the devastation of drought and a plague of locusts, Joel prophesied to the conscience of the children of Judah. He speaks about the plague of locusts in Israel, about the coming day of God, and the predicting of the outpouring of the Holy Spirit. As you read the book of Joel, you'll find that over half the book of Joel is about the plague of locusts. Joel speaks of a national calamity, of a famine resulting from the plague of locusts in Israel. He uses it to call for public mourning and humiliation in the land of Judah. There are four different names given in Joel, verses 1 through 4, to indicate different species of locusts or different stages of growth as the locusts were going ahead and going through the land and devouring everything that was in the land. Joel gives special attention to the destruction of the vines and the fruit trees, referring also to the complete destruction of all other plant life. In Joel 2, verse 3, we read, "A fire devoureth before them, and behind them a flame burneth. The land is as the Garden of Eden before them, and behind them a desolate wilderness, yea, and nothing shall escape them." And so we have a very, very devastating famine that's going on. The plague gives Joel an occasion to speak of a more terrible judgment yet to come, because these judgments that we find here in the book of Joel are but a foreshadow of the future. The locusts may be typical of those that we find mentioned in Revelation chapter 9, verses 1 through 11. Joel is a book that is used frequently, especially in the charismatic movement. You'll find a lot of reference in the charismatic movement to Joel chapter 2, and they talk about it, how this, you know, this is just a fulfillment of the book of Joel and the prophecies of Joel. Well, we're going to look just briefly at this, because in Acts chapter 2, verses 17 to 21, the Apostle Peter quotes from Joel 2, verses 28 to 32, as a prediction of the day of Pentecost. Now, as we look at this, take note, Peter does not specifically identify the events of Pentecost as being the fulfillment of Joel's prophecy. It's not the events themselves, but instead he points to the power. That which had taken place on Pentecost was the same thing Joel said would happen when the day of the Lord had come. And so Peter is not saying, this is a fulfillment, this is the day of the Lord. He's saying, the power, it's the same power. And so the same power that operated on the day of Pentecost will operate when the kingdom is established. In Joel chapter 3, Joel prophesies about the coming assembly of the nations in the valley of Jehoshaphat. This more than likely refers to the judgment of the nations for their treatment of God's covenant people. As you look at the situation in the Middle East today, it's very easy to see that the nations surrounding Israel have been unfriendly to Israel. They have been unkind to Israel. They have been cruel to Israel. And they've done everything they can to make it difficult for the nation of Israel. There's going to be a day in which there's going to be a judgment for those nations and for the treatment of those people. The prophet Joel sees a time of universal warfare before the millennium of peace. Joel chapter 3, verses 9 and 10, "Proclaim ye this among the Gentiles, prepare war, wake up the mighty men, let all the men of war draw near, let them come up. Beat your plowshares into swords." This isn't beating your swords into plowshares, this is beating your plowshares into swords. "And your pruning hooks into spears. Let the weak say, I am strong." And so there's going to be that time of universal warfare that is going to go on before that, in that day of the Lord. According to 2 Peter chapter 3, verse 10, the day of the Lord covers the entire period of the Great Tribulation, from the Great Tribulation to the passing away of the heavens and the earth. The verse says, "But the day of the Lord will come as a thief in the night, in the which the heavens shall pass away with great noise, and the elements shall melt with fervent heat. The earth also and the works that are therein shall be burned up." The gathering of the nations for war is also spoken of in Revelation chapter 16 and 19 as the battle of Armageddon. Joel also sees disturbances in the heavens, disturbances that correspond to the disturbances that we see happening in the Great Tribulation and at the second coming of Christ. Joel refers to this time in chapter 3, verses 13 to 15, when he writes, "Put ye in the sickle, for the harvest is ripe. Come, get you down, for the press is full, the fats overflow, for their wickedness is great. Multitudes, multitudes in the valley of decision, for the day of the Lord is near in the valley of decision. The sun and the moon shall be darkened, and the stars shall withdraw their shining." As we look at this and we see this prophecy that was made thousands of years ago, we find that these prophecies are beginning to be fulfilled even today. We're drawing up on this time. As you look at the nations of the earth aligning themselves against Israel and saying, boy, you know, Israel is a terrorist state. Look what they're doing to these poor Palestinians. There's no recognition of God's promise to the children of Israel that the land is going to be theirs. Because ultimately what we're seeing is we're seeing a rebellion against God. Why do you think Hitler tried to wipe out the Jews? I'm convinced that Hitler was demon-possessed. But I'm also convinced that Hitler tried to wipe out the Jews because the devil's goal is to wipe out the Jewish people. Because if the Jewish people are wiped off the face of the earth, God's word is proven to be false. But that's not going to happen because God says he's going to keep his people and there's going to be a remnant of his people that are going to survive, that are going to go to the end of the times. In the end, Joel finally describes the millennial blessing for Israel that's found in Joel chapter 3, verses 16 through 18, as the time in which the Lord shall also roar out of Zion and utter his voice from Jerusalem. In contrast to the famine caused by the locusts that Joel talked about, this is going to be a time of great fruitfulness in the land. In Joel chapter 3, verse 16, "The Lord also shall roar out of Zion and utter his voice from Jerusalem. The heavens and the earth shall shake, but the Lord shall be that will be the hope of his people and the strength of the children of Israel. So shall ye know that I am the Lord your God, dwelling in Zion, my holy mountain. Then shall Jerusalem be holy, and there shall no strangers pass through her any more." That's talking about the Gentiles there. "It shall come to pass in that day that the mountains shall drop down new wine, and the hills shall flow with milk, and all the rivers of Judah shall flow with waters, and a fountain shall come forth of the house of the Lord, and shall water the valley of Shittim." It's just incredible when you look at these prophecies in the Old Testament, because these prophecies, all of us have looked at the book of Revelation at different times. We've heard preaching on the book of Revelation. But as you look at the minor prophets, there's an incredible amount of Bible prophecy dealing with the end times that you find in the writings of the minor prophets. And it all ties in so directly and so clearly and concisely with God's plan as revealed in the book of Daniel and as revealed in the book of Revelation. All of these things tie together in a spectacular way. Joel pictures the temporal blessings of a drought being broken by refreshing rains, and the land once again becoming productive. God gave a great importance to this short book of Joel. We read in Joel chapter 1, verse 3, "Tell ye your children of it, and let your children tell their children, and their children another generation." And so this is a prophecy that was an ongoing prophecy to the children of Israel, reminding them that God is going to provide for them, that he's going to care for them, and someday they're going to be back in Mount Zion, and the Lord shall roar out of Zion. You know, that's going to be an incredible day. I try to picture it in my mind. I don't know about you, but I like to try to picture things in my mind when I read these things. And having been at Jerusalem, Pastor and I walked all over the Mount of Olives and all over by the Eastern Gate one day when we were there. And we even went in a cave. It was a burial site. And I think there were like 52 graves in there. And it was a private person that brought us in there. And it was really an incredible thing to be down in there, and then an incredible thing to walk up by the Eastern Gate and to stand right before that closed Eastern Gate so that Christ can't come riding back in. Well, I have a surprise for him. He's going to ride back in there. You know, the reason the Mohammedans have gone ahead and the Islamic people have gone ahead, they have put their graveyard right in front of the Eastern Gate because they figure Christ would never go ahead and ride in over the graves. But, you know, when the Mount of Olives splits wide open, my guess is they're going to split it wide open all the way to the Eastern Gate because the Eastern Great Gate's going to open at the same time. It's not going to be a problem. Christ won't be defiled by riding on those graves. Anyway, it's really incredible when you see some of these things. We look now at Amos. Amos was a herdsman. Amos lived in a time of material prosperity. Again, we make mention of the long reigns of Uzziah in Judah and Jeroboam II in Israel. These brought stability, prosperity, and economic expansion to the two kingdoms. Once again, the Assyrians, of course, the nation was in decline at that point. It looked as though the nation was beginning to fall apart, although we know it was revived later on because they carried Israel into captivity. Amos was a sheep farmer. He was a sheep farmer from the village of Tekoa, a small village about 6 miles south of Bethlehem. When you go to Israel, if any of you are going to Israel this coming year, you're not going to be able to go to the village of Tekoa. Because by the time you hit Bethlehem, you're going to be in an area that you more than likely aren't going to want to be in. Generally speaking, the farthest south I've been is actually Bethlehem. No, in 1985 we did all the way down to Hebron. And so that was a long time ago. Boy, it's hard to believe. The Hebrew word used for shepherd actually suggests that he was more than just a shepherd. He was a sheep breeder. This means that Amos managed or owned large herds of sheep and goats, and was probably in charge of the other shepherds. Besides being a shepherd, Amos was also occupied in the business of growing sycamore fruit. Now, these trees grew in the warmer lowlands by the Jordan Valley and in the oases by the Dead Sea. We find that then that Amos was a breeder, rancher, farmer. He was a breeder, rancher, farmer who was prominent and respected in his community. One of the things that you find in the men that God uses down through history is that many of these people have had a lot of time alone. And spending time alone with God is very important. Well, as a shepherd, Amos was able to spend time alone with God in the wilderness, and God prepared the heart of Amos in those times of being alone to minister to the nation of Israel. Many times God takes his people quietly preparing them for the time that he has for them to step forward. That's why it's so vital in the Christian life to always be seeking the face of God, to be seeking God's direction, looking for his direction and his guidance for your life. You never know exactly how God is going to raise up his leaders. But you can know and you can trust God to lead and to guide. Although he was a native of Judah, God called Amos to minister to Israel. The northern kingdom was at the peak of its power. Jeroboam II was able to extend his kingdom northward into the Aramean territory and to reclaim Israel lands in the Transjordan area. And this gave Israel control over the trade routes. And as they controlled the trade routes, the wealth began to accumulate in her cities. The rich were building summer houses and winter palaces made out of ivory in which they laid around on silk cushions, living extravagant, indulgent lifestyles, while the poor became the targets of legal and economic exploitation. Kind of reminds you a little bit of what's going on with the nation, with the United States, doesn't it? People are wealthy, and they're able to do all kinds of things. And if you hear music going right now, my phone's not on vibrate. And it takes too much work to put this one on vibrate. Anyway, we'll go right on. Did you hear it? Oh, say, can you see by the dawn's? Anyway, it reminds you so much of the United States, because we have so many people in the United States. They not only have their big winter palaces up here in Hawthorne Woods and Long Grove and South Barrington, but they have their summer homes in other places, in Florida and Arizona and California. And we live in a very, very affluent society that has been built around trade, just as Israel became a very affluent society through trade as well. Religion was flourishing in the nation of Israel during this time, with the Israelites flocking to their pagan shrines for their yearly festivals. They really believed that Baal had given them the prosperity and given them the great crops. But they equated, in many ways, they were equated Baal with the God of Israel. They believed that God was with them, and they considered themselves to be immune to disaster. It's kind of like the United States once again, isn't it? What do we have in this country? We have a country that's departed from the living God. We have a country that has lived in peace and prosperity and security for years. And when the trade buildings were hit and the Pentagon was hit on 9/11, our whole nation went into shock. It was like, what? This can happen to us? Listen, that's the tip of the iceberg of what can happen to us. We think that our nation can stand forever, and it can't. They forgot that idolatry has always resulted in shame and misery from the time that Jeroboam instituted the golden calf worship at Bethel, and of course, even before. The ministry of Amos probably lasted for no more than a year. It took place 2 years before a notable earthquake. Josephus, the Jewish historian, connects the earthquake with the events of 2 Chronicles 26, verses 16 through 20, when King Uzziah lifted up himself and burned incense in the temple. Archaeological excavations at Hazor and Samaria have uncovered evidence of a violent earthquake in Israel around the year of 760 B.C. While the nation was experiencing great prosperity during this time, in less than 40 years, the northern kingdom was about to fall. And once again, we have a word of warning, because we're experiencing, once again, great prosperity. The economy is starting to rise. 260,000 new jobs in the last couple of months now. And all of a sudden, there's an economic boom that seems to be on the horizon. And everybody's very optimistic again. But you know, in 40 years, we could be gone too. It doesn't take 40 years for a nation to be destroyed. Amos tells us that he was not born into the priesthood, nor was he a part of the company of the prophets. He did not choose his calling for himself, but God called him when he was a herdsman and a gatherer of sycamore fruit, saying, "Go, prophesy unto my people Israel." Amos set a fine example for us, because his response was to obey, leaving the pastures of the wilderness and turning his back on his place of birth, speaking the word of the Lord in Samaria, the capital of the northern kingdom. Amos opened his prophecy by quoting from Joel chapter 3, verse 16, showing us that the book of Joel was obviously written before his book was written. And he closes his address with another quote from Joel. The theme of his preaching is national accountability for national sins. National accountability for national sins. And he exhorted the people, prepare to meet thy God, O Israel. His prophesying was directed to a nation of people who had often pledged fidelity to the true God, but was now worshiping idols. We'll look briefly at Amos' contemporaries. It's very possible that as a boy, Amos knew Jonah. He may have heard of his visit to Nineveh. It's also very possible that he knew Elisha and have heard of his relationship with Elijah. Jonah and Elisha were passing off the scene as Amos was coming on the scene. Hosea was a co-worker with Amos and may have been in Bethel during the time of Amos' visit there. Hosea was younger than Amos and continued his work after Amos was gone. Just as he was closing his work, Isaiah and Micah were beginning their work. All of this points to the extreme effort that God put forth to try to avert the doom of his children. Amos was a prophet, of course, from Judah, which was Israel's rival nation. Now, if you stop and think about it, you get a guy that comes from a rival nation who's predicting your doom. It's not going to be very well accepted. But this prophet Amos appears in the middle of a corrupt nation, the corrupt nation of Israel, and it begins with a remarkable tact. He gets the attention of everybody who's listening to him by denouncing the enemies of Israel. He begins with Syria. After he pronounces the destruction of Syria and denounces them, he proclaims God's judgment on Philistia and on Tyre. Now, Philistia, you know, of course, was southwest of Israel. Tyre was northwest of Israel, the Phoenicians. He moves close to home as he denounces Edom, Ammon, and Moab, which, of course, where the nation of Israel fought with them, of course, in the Transjordan area. These were all blood relatives of Israel. His listeners must have been amazed when he brought his searing prophecies against his own people, Judah, which was hated by the Israelites. He reaches the climax of his message in Amos chapter 2, verse 6. Thus saith the Lord, for three transgressions of Israel and for four, I will not turn away the punishment thereof. Amos went beneath the veneer of Israelite society and exposed the sinfulness and national decay that invited God's judgment. Having already addressed the sins in their society, he now goes on to attack their apostate religion with Bethel at its center. His primary message was a message of righteousness, which was necessary for the security of the nation and the stability of religion. Where there is no righteousness, ritual cannot divert impending disaster. Amos knew that his call to righteousness would not be heard, so he moved quickly on to pronouncing judgment, referring to the coming captivity of Israel. He used five illustrations to show the doom of Israel. He first pointed to the locust plague. Second, to a fire sweeping the nation. Both of these were turned away by the prayers of the prophet. But next came the vision of the plumb line. God's word is the plumb line by which every nation is tested. Israel's national edifice was so crudely and weakly constructed that it would not stand the test of the plumb line. The vision, Amos's vision of the summer fruit showed the rottenness of this nation, which had repudiated God's word, proclaiming a famine not of bread and water, but of hearing the words of the Lord. In his final vision, Amos revealed the hopelessness of escaping from God's judgment. In Amos chapter 9, verse 2, he writes, "Though they dig into hell, thence shall mine hand take them. Though they climb up to heaven, thence will I bring them down." In the middle of his prophecies, Amos was interrupted by Amaziah, the priest of Bethel, who commanded him to return to Judah. Now you have to understand, his preaching was so effective that this priest went to Jeroboam II and said that his prophecies were shaking the land. In return, though, we find that Amos prophesied of the captivity for his priests and that his wife would become a harlot for the Assyrian soldiers. Amos didn't really defend himself. Amos answered this in Amos chapter 7, verses 14 and 15. "Then answered Amos and said to Amaziah, I was no prophet, neither was I a prophet's son, but I was an herdman and a gatherer of sycamore fruit. And the Lord took me as I followed the flock. And the Lord said unto me, Go prophesy unto my people Israel." As the other and the other prophets that we have studied, Amos did not leave his listeners in despair. He declares that there is going to be a bright new day coming, and that God would free his people from captivity. In Amos chapter 9, verses 11 through 15, we read, "In that day will I raise up the tabernacle of David that is fallen." That's words of encouragement. "And close up the breaches thereof, and I will raise up his ruins, and I will build it as in the days of old, that they may possess the remnant of Edom and of all the heathen which are called by my name, saith the Lord that doeth this. Behold, the days come, saith the Lord, that the plowman shall overtake the reaper, and the treader of grapes him that soweth seed, and the mountain shall drop sweet wine, and all the hills shall melt. And I will bring again the captivity of my people Israel, and they shall build the waste cities, and inhabit them. And they shall plant vineyards, and shall drink the wine thereof, and they shall also make gardens, and eat the fruit of them. And I will plant them upon their land, and they shall no more be pulled up out of their land, which I have given them, saith the Lord their God." You know, there's going to be a day coming when Israel will be in the land and never be taken out again. I believe that Israel will be taken out of the land one more time. And that's going to come during the tribulation. We next look at the book of Obadiah. With its 21 verses, the book of Obadiah is the shortest book in the Old Testament. It contains a message of doom and judgment and is never quoted in the New Testament. Obadiah speaks exclusively to Edom, which is spoken of in Scripture more frequently than any other nation except Babylon. Obadiah presents the message of a God of justice whose righteousness demands vengeance upon Edom, Israel's enemy. There are more than 20 different predictions about Edom in the Old Testament, including those in Isaiah 34 and 63, in Jeremiah 49 and Ezekiel 35. Obadiah was likely written after the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple. The Edomites, of course, had greatly contributed to the misery of the children of Judah, encouraging the Babylonians in their destruction of Jerusalem. They, of course, had submitted to King Nebuchadnezzar and had won his temporary favor. And they are represented as triumphing over the ruin of their kinsmen, since they hoped to obtain a large portion of the desolate land for themselves. The animosity between Edom and Israel was long and deep, going all the way back to the rivalry between Esau and Jacob and their children. When Israel was marching through the wilderness, it was the Edomites who refused to allow them to march through their land. They hated Israel because God had prospered her. Historically, their policy was consistently vindictive against Israel. Their behavior toward Israel in the light of the Abrahamic covenant marked the Edomites for divine judgment in spite of their alliances and national security from the mountains surrounding them. Ezekiel had accused Edom of perpetual hatred. Obadiah warned Edom of God's coming retribution. He predicted that the Edomites would be cut off forever and be as though they had not been. Along with this prediction, he also predicted that a remnant of Judah would be saved and that the kingdom of Judah would yet prevail. 150 years later, Malachi prophesied, showing that Edom had been driven out of the mountains, but later returned and built their rebuilt their desolate places, only to be completely overthrown later. Malachi speaks of Edom as followed. In Malachi 1 verse 4, whereas Edom said, "We are impoverished, but we will return and build the desolate places. Thus saith the Lord of hosts, they shall build, but I will throw down. They shall call them the border of wickedness and the people against whom the Lord hath indignation forever." The ruins of Edom are very impressive. If you've ever gone to the city of Petra, you have seen the ruins of the Edomites. You go into the mountains by Petra, you have the city that's carved out of solid rock. It's breathtaking, but it's also a relic of a city of immense strength and one of the wonders of the world. There are 30 ruined towns in a small area there. In Obadiah 1 verse 3, we read, "The pride of thine heart hath deceived thee, thou that dwellest in the clefts of the rock, whose habitation is high, that saith in his heart, who shall bring me down to the ground?" By 582 BC, 4 years after the destruction of Jerusalem, the Babylonians invaded and raided the Edomites. The Edomites then were taken over by the Nabataeans. The few Edomites that were left were confined to a region in South Judea, where for four centuries they continued to exist as active enemies of the Jews. In 126 BC, one of the Maccabean rulers subdued the Edomites and required them to be circumcised and absorbed them into the Jewish state. In 63 BC, when the Romans conquered Palestine, the Herods, an Edomite family, were placed in control of Judah. King Herod, who tried to kill the infant Christ, was an Edomite, whose brutal slaughter of the infants in Bethlehem was representative of the Edomites. In 70 AD, with the destruction of Jerusalem, they disappeared from history. In AD 636, the prophecy of the cities of the Edomites themselves being completely desolated were fulfilled when the Mohammedans overran the country. Obadiah, as the other prophets, concludes his prophecy by speaking of the future restoration of Israel, carefully pointing out that Israel shall then possess the land of Esau. As you can see, we've looked at a lot of prophecies this morning that are not minor prophecies. They may be called the minor prophets, but what they have to say is incredible. Thank you. We'll pick up next time. Jonah, Micah, Nahum, Habakkuk.